Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, August 12th, 2019. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho Legislative Interim Committee discusses paying for Medicaid expansion and its sideboards, even as it really doesn't know how much the sideboards and Medicaid expansion will cost because the federal government has to approve some of the sideboards. The University of Idaho will leave 12 faculty positions unfilled to cut expenses. Idaho Cannabis Coalition can start gathering signatures to get medical marijuana on the ballot in Idaho. Moscow Committee wants disaster aid money to repair East 6th Street Bridge over Paradise Creek, damaged in April 9th flood. Rain slows down wildfires in eastern Washington and diesel leak from Lower Monumental Dam. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in the Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Heavy rains in northeastern and north-central Washington over the weekend slowed down the Williams Flats fire, burning 50 miles west of Spokane on the Calvo Reservation. The rains caused 64 firefighters to stay on the fire line overnight Saturday because flash flooding made the way back to a command post unsafe. Some of the firefighters were able to sleep in vehicles. 1.32 inches of rain fell near the fire, which is 40% contained. About 1,200 firefighters were working on the blaze as of yesterday. The Moscow City Council's Public Works Finance Committee this afternoon recommended the full City Council submit an Idaho Department of Commerce grant application under the Idaho Community Development Block Grant Program for $100,000 in post-disaster assistance to repair the East 6th Street Bridge over Paradise Creek. City Public Works Department Senior Engineer Nate Sir described the damage to the bridge on the east side of the city due to the April flooding.
There was pretty significant flood damage, the majority of it occurring on the upstream side here. So there was damage to the culverts, the head wall, the face there, and there was a pretty substantial undermining of the road that you can see here. So the road base was all washed out and the asphalt collapsed over top of it. Now, since to preserve safety, our crews have gone back in, replaced a portion of the road base, and put a temporary asphalt pavement over top. And they're working with Idaho Transportation Department to get some jersey barrier out there to back up this guardrail, which was pretty substantially undermined. And then on the downstream side, it fared a little better, but there was still undermining, headwall damage, less culvert damage there, but also damage to the roadway.
That was Moscow Public Works Senior Engineer Nate Sir. City Grants Coordinator Lisa Anderson told the committee city staff received information in April that the Idaho Department of Emergency Management and the Federal Emergency Management Agency do not pay for permanent road repairs on streets classified as major collectors. After that, city staff decided to go after the $100,000 Idaho Commerce Department grant. Anderson outlined some of the other flood damage in the city due to the April 9th storm.
In-house, based upon the costs that the city incurred on the day of the flood event and for a few days thereafter, and then with additional repairs and maintenance, as you've seen, or repairs on Mountain View, we had by Joseph, and Mountain View, we had a manhole that was washed out around it, and additional damages to the grate that's there by the playfields on Joseph and Mountain View. So we had some additional costs too in-house. Some have been completely repaired at this point, others have not. There were damages to our parks and to Paradise Path in a few areas. So overall, with the cost of the sandbagging and the recovery efforts, I was able to determine that we had about $35,000 in expenses. Some of those expenses were covered or will be covered by an insurance claim that was submitted through ICRIMP, and they agreed to combine it under one claim instead of having a deductible of $2,500 on several claims that may not be eligible at that point. I'm estimating that to be at a minimum $35,000, but it could possibly be more. So that gives us some additional funding to add to the cost of the bridge. And then we were able in the FY20 budget to identify some additional resources available depending upon the action that the council would like to move forward when we receive the proposals from JUB.
That was Moscow Grants Coordinator Elisa Anderson. Staff is proposing to extend the culverts on the East 6th Street Bridge to a new headwall or slope paving to mitigate erosion potential and to provide adequate separation between the travel lanes and culvert ends and to continue sidewalks across Paradise Creek to provide pedestrian connectivity on both sides of East 6th Street. City staff is in discussion with JUB Engineers Incorporated to prepare a topographic survey and base map and alternative analysis to determine the best method for repair and or replacement of the existing bridge. The Public Works Committee put the grant application item on the consent agenda for the next City Council meeting, which will be held Monday night next week. The Idaho Transportation Department reopened U.S. Highway 95 to two-way traffic north of Riggins at about 6 p.m. last night after a mudslide halted traffic entirely earlier in the weekend. ITD spokesperson Megan Sauser told the Lewiston Tribune they have reduced the speed limit in the mudslide area at milepost 200 to 45 miles per hour. The mudslide was caused by heavy rain and hail Friday night, which brought mud, boulders, and debris onto the roadway. The road was closed completely from Friday evening until about 7 p.m. Saturday. Fiddle Creek Fruit and Hardware store owner Jim Rupp said the mudslide destroyed much of his fruit crop. While the highway was closed, alternate north-south routes included the Grangeville Salmon Road through the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest and highways through Pendleton, Oregon. The U.S. Forest Service has announced it will spend $25,000 on a state-federal project in eastern Idaho to identify roadkill animals in a major wildlife migration corridor that crosses U.S. Highway 20 and State Highway 87 so it can make better decisions about placing wildlife crossing structures. The Forest Service says 75% of the historical Greater Yellowstone ecosystem migration routes for elk, bison, and pronghorn sheep have been lost, and many current migration routes have a high rate of wildlife vehicle collisions where they cross major highways. The ongoing project started this summer using volunteers to identify dead animals on the two highways. Fremont County residents voted in favor of a non-binding resolution last year expressing opposition to wildlife crossing structures because they might hurt property values. University of Idaho officials say the school will leave a dozen faculty positions unfilled as part of its belt tightening this school year. Vice President for Finance and Administration Bill Foisey said the UI is facing a $3 million reduction in spending across all units and another $2 million that the school will reallocate to areas deemed to be of strategic importance, such as university communications, marketing, information technology, student affairs, and the Office of Research and Economic Development. Foisey told the Lewiston Tribune the university could take similar actions when working on its fiscal year 2021 budget. Meanwhile, school officials expect the cost of employee health care plan expenses to increase. Foisey said, if you expect expenses to be higher than the previous year, there are two pressure release valves. One is increased revenue, and there's only two ways to do that. Either the state gives us more money, or these students give us more money. We're not anticipating increases in either one of those. New University of Idaho President C. Scott Green said he will convene a working group this fall to find long-term budget strategies. Green said more cuts may impact morale, so his administration needs to provide stability to the institution, build faculty trust by including them in the decision-making processes and be as transparent as possible.
Idaho science and math teachers are coming together this week to talk about how to promote STEM in the classroom. The Great Idaho STEM Together Conference takes place Tuesday and Wednesday in Coeur d'Alene to focus on science, technology, engineering, and math teaching at elementary and high school levels. Teachers are sharing ways they get students interested in these fields. Julie Amador is an associate professor at the University of Idaho and former elementary school teacher.
One of the things we're trying to do is think about kids' natural interests and then relate those to science, technology, engineering, and math and help them build off things that they're interested in. And also thinking just long-term about career and the pipeline for jobs in the future.
There's massive potential for kids who want to make a career in these fields. According to the Idaho STEM Action Center, there are more than 6,300 unfilled STEM jobs in the Gem State. The conference is at Lake City High School. Regional math specialist at the University of Idaho Coeur d'Alene, Abe Wallin, says all the major sciences will be represented, and there will be presentations on how to bring engineering and technology into the classroom, such as problem-solving exercises and robotics. He also notes STEM isn't just important for kids' career paths. A focus on these fields also can help solve local issues.
Getting kids aware that it's not just somebody in a laboratory all the time who's doing STEM. There's lots of people. There's the loggers, foresters. All those folks are still engaged in STEM-related fields.
Wallin says even for kids who don't make a career with STEM, the fields can teach them how to better understand the world.
One specific area is data and being a good consumer of data and being able to read the paper or see statistics and sort of decode some of that. I think that's a benefit for all of our students.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. The Idaho Legislature's Interim Committee on Medicaid Expansion suggested ways to pay for Medicaid expansion when they met in Boise Friday. The state expects to implement the voter-approved Medicaid expansion January 1st, and the legislature has already provided money to fund the first 6 months of the program. Lawmakers on the Interim Committee have proposed ending the mostly county-funded catastrophic health care program for those who lack health insurance. With Medicaid expansion as passed by voters, the need for the approximately $20 million annual program was expected to go away, but Republicans in the legislature insisted on adding sideboards to the Medicaid expansion this year, which will mean some of those in the state's so-called Medicaid gap will likely fall through the cracks or otherwise not qualify for Medicaid. Medicaid expansion was intended to provide health care coverage for those earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level. Currently, those who make more than the poverty level are not eligible for Medicaid, and the federally subsidized Affordable Care Act only covers people who make more than 138% of the federal poverty rate. One controversial sideboard is a work requirement for Medicaid recipients, which can be fulfilled by working, looking for a job, or community volunteering for 20 hours per week. Another controversial sideboard targets women by requiring they get approval from their primary health care provider before going to another provider for family planning services. Under the sideboards legislation passed this year, the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare must ask the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to approve any of the various sideboards. The Associated Press reports Republican Representative Fred Wood of Burley, who co-chairs the Interim Committee on Medicaid Expansion, said Friday, "If all of the waivers are approved, we're going to have a significant population that is not eligible for Medicaid." That would mean there would still be a significant need for the mostly county-funded catastrophic health care fund. Democratic Representative Brooke Green of Boise said, "If we have savings at the county level, we should have an obligation to pass that back to our property owners. We're looking to our counties to pay for this, and the cost of doing business for our counties isn't going to change. I think we really need to look at ways to keep them whole." Lawmakers on the committee suggested using money from the state's Millennium Fund. The Millennium Fund came from the 2000 tobacco settlement. So far, the Millennium Fund has paid for smoking cessation programs and other health initiatives, such as establishing peer-run recovery centers to help people recovering from addiction or mental health issues. During the legislative session, Democrats lashed out at Governor Brad Little for signing the Medicaid sideboards bill in April. A statement issued April 9th said, instead of implementing Medicaid expansion the Idaho way, Governor Little and the majority ignored the voters and created a fiscally irresponsible program likely to end up in court. This legislation is designed to restrict people's access to Medicaid expansion while costing the state millions every year. It is inevitable that there will be a second gap population when Idahoans cannot jump the ridiculous hurdles that the majority has put up to get health care coverage. The same legislature refused to pass Medicaid expansion because it was too expensive. Now, ironically, the legislature is willing to drain our coffers and deny Idahoans health care coverage. At the time, Democratic Representative Melissa Wintrow of Boise said the Medicaid expansion sideboards are likely to cost the state $40 million per year. When the legislature passed the work requirements, they ignored the decision of a federal judge who struck down Medicaid work reporting requirements in Kentucky and Arkansas the week before. Former Idaho Health and Welfare Department Director Dick Armstrong pointed out in an op-ed piece just before Little signed the bill, that the judge in that case wrote he struck down the work reporting requirements because they, quote, violate the central tenet of the Medicaid program to furnish medical care to low-income individuals. Taking away coverage does not advance the objectives of the program and is therefore illegal. The judge also noted the Trump administration did not adequately consider how the work requirements would impact health care for the poor before it approved them. The Idaho sideboards specify people can be kicked off Medicaid for not meeting the work requirements, and there's question as to whether that is legal. There's also a provision that adds copays to medical patients' bills if they don't meet the work requirement. National Health Law Program Senior Attorney Catherine McKee told the Twin Falls Times News, that's another potential hurdle there. Just imposing heightened cost sharing on the population itself may not be permissible. Regarding the referral requirement for family planning, McKee said, it is just bad and terrible policy to require someone to get a referral for family planning services. Medicaid, which serves millions of women of childbearing age, has rules requiring Medicaid programs to cover family planning services and supplies and forbids states from making it difficult for women to access them. The National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association wrote several years ago, the right to freely choose to receive family planning services from any qualified participating Medicaid provider is an essential protection designed to ensure that Medicaid beneficiaries have ready access to the health services they need when they need them and from a provider they trust. Federal law guarantees that Medicaid beneficiaries can receive family planning services from any qualified Medicaid provider. This principle is referred to as freedom of choice. The Twin Falls Times News reported a federal Medicaid program manual for states says patients are allowed to choose, quote, any qualified provider, unquote, for family planning services. However, the Trump administration has signaled it will sign off on major changes in Medicaid that restrict poor people's access to health care. Governor Brad Little alluded to that situation on July 30th when he told the Boise Metro Chamber of Commerce that he had been on the phone with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services director earlier in the day. The Idaho Press reported Little said, she and I are having quite a relationship given all the things that we're doing in Idaho right now. But former Idaho Supreme Court Chief Justice Jim Jones told the Twin Falls Times News in April he has his doubts the Trump administration can get away with restricting the poor's access to health care the way Idaho lawmakers want to through Medicaid expansion sideboards. Jones, who is now working for a private law firm, said they've kind of tipped their hand that they're anxious to have people come in and seek waivers. But I think as a systemic matter, they haven't gotten the procedures in place to ensure that they're going to be evaluated in an even-handed manner. You better have a case that you can make. And I think we will probably run into the same difficulty. Here we are hacking and thrashing in the legislature. Let's do this, let's do that, and it doesn't seem to be a fact-based procedure. And I think when the dust settles, there's going to have to be a pretty good showing that it's not going to impede people from having coverage, and it's not going to keep people from getting service. Idaho Secretary of State Lawrence Denny announced Friday the Idaho Cannabis Coalition's petition to get medical cannabis initiatives on the 2020 ballot have met all requirements to begin gathering signatures. Those who support legalized medical marijuana have until April 30th of next year to collect just over 55,000 valid voter signatures to get the initiative on the ballot. Under Idaho's citizen initiative restrictions, the group must gather signatures from at least 6% of the registered voters in 18 out of the state's 35 legislative districts for the initiative to get on the ballot, and county election officials may throw out otherwise valid signatures if the voter registers to vote at a new address after signing the petition. The Idaho Medical Marijuana Act would establish, quote, a medical marijuana program for qualifying patients and protect participants from criminal prosecution and civil sanction. The person behind the petition is 77-year-old John Belleville, who has been on opiates for peripheral neuropathy. Belleville says his doctors have told him his use of opiates to treat pain is causing his organs to fail. Idaho Cannabis Coalition spokesperson Russ Belleville, who is John Belleville's son, told the Idaho Statesman medical cannabis has been shown in numerous scientific studies to be especially effective at relieving neuropathic pain. Having visited me in Oregon and trying it for himself, my dad knows what millions of Americans in 33 other states already know, medical marijuana works for his condition, period. John Belleville, who has lived in Idaho all his life, said, I want to be able to live out my last years here in Idaho. Without medical marijuana, there will be fewer of those years, and they'll be filled with pain. Why shouldn't I be able to use the same medical marijuana that people are using legally across almost every Idaho border? Signature gatherers will also be working to get a minimum wage increase on the 2020 state ballot. Idahoans for a Fair Wage Initiative would increase the minimum wage in the state from the current $7.25 per hour to $12 per hour over a four-year period. Idahoans for a Fair Wage faces the same signature gathering requirements that the group collecting signatures for the medical cannabis initiative are. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers reported last week up to 300 gallons of unspecified turbine oil leaked into the Snake River from a turbine shaft at Lower Monumental Dam, about 40 miles northeast of Pasco. The announcement does not say when the leak occurred. Under a settlement agreement, the Corps must disclose leaks at 8 dams on the Lower Snake River and Columbia River to state regulators and the environmental group Columbia Riverkeeper. The Tri-City Herald reports the turbine unit on the dam is out of service while the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers concludes an investigation which involves taking an inventory of all oil used to lubricate the turbine to determine how much is missing. The Corps said in a statement, "We've improved our oil accountability program over time, and while our systems aren't perfect, the lessons learned have greatly improved our overall ability to track and contain oil. We'll continue refining these procedures because our goal is not to spill any oil." The Corps says other turbines on the Columbia Snake system will compensate for the lost power generating ability of the Lower Monumental Dam turbine. Columbia Riverkeeper lead attorney Miles Johnson said in a news release, oil pollution from Lower Monumental Dam is just one more reason to remove the four obsolete aging dams on the Lower Snake River. Two Central Idaho ranch owners have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Forest Service over their plan to widen and level a pedestrian bike recreation path on their land going from the small town of Stanley to Redfish Lake. The Forest Service has a 2005 easement deed that allows a 30-foot wide trail to cross 1.5 miles of the private land. The lawsuit says the easement does not allow the Forest Service to bring machinery into the area to improve the trail. The lawsuit by Sawtooth Mountain Ranch owners David Boren and Lynn Arnon says the court should rule the federal government, quote, may not enter and construct, use, or maintain a developed commuter trail through the property. The suit says signs could be put up on the trail in an unaltered landscape. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, we're expecting clear skies through Wednesday. Low 48 tonight, high 81 tomorrow, low 51 Tuesday night, high 83 Wednesday, partly cloudy, low 52 Wednesday night, and mostly sunny Thursday, high 81. Currently 76 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Coming up next, Eat the Airwaves Part 2, News and Opinions from the West Side, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. At 7:30, live in the studios, Disability Talk Northwest, with talk and music about disabilities. And at 9 o'clock, music begins in earnest with Phobic Friends on the air. And at 11 o'clock, Jeremy Scahill's Intercepted. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP is sponsored in part by Palouse Ocularium, creating fine eyewear for your lifestyle through eye exams, unique glasses, and contact lenses. Find Palouse Ocularium at 7th and Washington in Moscow, 208-883-3937, and PalouseOcularium.com. KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and environmentalism.